I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at Burrow.com/ACAST. That's Burrow.com/ACAST. Burrow.com/ACAST.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Welcome to episode 133 of the podcast, everybody, with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel. Andrew, last week, new Top Gear, as it's known, turned 20 years old. The first episode of the studio-based Top Gear aired on the 20th of October 2002. So 20 years ago last week. And so it seemed like a good time to sort of discuss its influence, its legacy, what it meant to you and I, because I think we'll come at this from two very different perspectives. I was 15 when it first went out and a total petrol head. You were already a well-established... you were already a well-established car journalist. You probably knew...
Thank you. I was 36.
There you go. You probably knew many of the people involved.
In fact, I was older then than you are now. That's quite annoying.
Well, I won't rub it in. So we came at it from very different perspectives, and I think we might view it slightly differently, but we'll see. And the reason for doing this is because it became a global phenomenon, didn't it, that Top Gear? And unlike any other thing in the world of car journalism, it just became enormous.
I mean, I was told, and this was many years ago, but I suspect it's probably true, that it was the BBC's second best-selling export after Doctor Who.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah, now, I don't know whether that was back in the, you know, the Clarkson, Hammond, May era exclusively, or whether that's still the case today. But it gives you some idea, doesn't it, of the, not just the impact over here, but the truly global reach of this programme, which is why, you know, everybody who has stood in front of those cameras for any period of time for the last 20 years is now a... you know, an internationally recognised celebrity. Which, given that some of them my mates, I always find that really quite curious. But, I'm sure we'll talk about that later on. But yes, it's a global phenomenon. That's the point. Somebody also once told me that, and again, this information is ancient, so it's probably even more now, that Stig merchandising alone returned £8 million to the BBC coffers.
Just Stig stuff.
Just Stig merchandising. Just T-shirts going, I'm the Stig, or whatever. Yeah. And again, that was years ago, so it may be more, maybe less, but it just gives you an idea of just how important the show is.
At its peak, it was airing in more than 200 countries. How many countries are there? I mean, that's almost all of them.
Well,
isn't it?
Somewhere between 200 and 300. So, I think we can constantly say most of them.
And it's often said that it ultimately had a viewership at its peak of 350 million people around the world. Although apparently, I've been reading about it, that's an unreliable figure.
Okay.
But it was a titan at its peak, in its heyday.
It's interesting that you're using the past tense there.
Well, it's... Okay, I'm only doing that because, and I want to clear this up right at the beginning. So we're talking about studio era Top Gear that started in 2002, 20 years ago. We're going to call that new Top Gear. Anything that came before is old Top Gear. But I'm also talking about the Clarkson era specifically. We're not talking about the Grand Tour afterwards. New Top Gear, I watch every episode and it's great. And our mate Chris is I think he's the main presenter. But we're not really talking about that era of Top Gear. We're talking about the Clarkson era of studio Top Gear that became the phenomenon. We can touch on the current iteration if we want to.
I think we should.
Yeah, okay, fine. But so when we say new and old Top Gear, it's that 2002, that's the sort of break point between old and new. Now, I was thinking about this earlier. This was long before iPlayer. And so if something went out and you missed it, you missed it. It was gone pretty much. You know, they might repeat it or it might appear on Dave years later
We had things called video recorders even 20 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
So I used to do it. I used to, because I couldn't guarantee to be around. I'd always record Top Gear, and I was even smart enough to be able to program my video recorder to record it at the same time every week. So all I'd need to make sure is that I actually had a tape in the machine, and there it would be. But it just seems so clunky now, doesn't it?
It really does. Just imagine kids. Well, probably your kids can't believe you ever had to do that. But the point is, I missed that first episode. So I hadn't seen it until last week.
Oh, okay.
When Richard Porter tweeted a link to it on iPlayer. And so I went back and watched it. And it was so interesting to watch it now. Because we think of studio era Top Gear as new Top Gear and everything that came with it. But actually, go back and watch that first episode from 2002. And it's a hybrid of old Top Gear and new Top Gear. It doesn't feel like Top Gear as we think of it at all. So they've got the studio, but there's hardly anyone in it.
There wasn't even an audience, was there?
There's a few people, literally a few people. They have the test track and they do things like star in a reasonably priced car. They've got the Stig. They do lap times with supercars. So that's all quite new Top Gear as we think of it. But some of the scripting, some of the shots, some of the texture and feel of it, it's old Top Gear, clearly a hangover from 90s television production. So the angles, sometimes there'll be a shot of a presenter doing a piece to camera from very up high, or there'll be a presenter looking down the barrel of the camera and then he'll turn his back and the camera will zoom in and you see his face in a door mirror. It's that sort of thing, the very sort of 90s style of television production.
And also, they also did sort of some serious stuff, didn't they? It wasn't
well, they
all
did.
Knockabout. Yeah. And again, that's a throwback to old Top Gear. Are we going to talk about old Top Gear at all?
Okay, we can do, I know you were
a zygote at the time, but...
No, I remember watching it. But this first episode of new Top Gear was... James May wasn't part of the team then. It was Jason Dore instead. And you're right. I suspect what they were doing was just leaning into Jason's strengths. And so there is a lot of him scrawling on... windscreens with chalk pen, talking about money off, talking about deals on new cars. So clearly they wanted Top Gear to have this kind of consumer benefit. And later on, they just abandoned that entirely.
I always felt a bit sorry for Jason. I mean, I haven't seen him for years, but I used to know Jason pretty well because we used to do stuff at the Sunday Times together. He's a really, really nice guy. And he kind of went after one series. And I think the perception always was that he wasn't good enough. My understanding, and I may be completely wrong, is that they just decided to steer the show. I think they realized that the knockabout stuff just worked better. Mm. And the consumer stuff was kind of like quite old school. And so they just steered the program away from it, and then they brought James in for the second series, and the rest is history.
The only other thing that I wanted to comment on from that first episode was, you see how their attitude changed over the subsequent years, because later on it became willfully irresponsible. They had this tone that they could not care less, and actually it seemed as though they set about trying to wind people up and upset people, even offend
people.
But in this first episode, there was a segment where Richard Hammond, tries to see if you can drive past the Gatso speed camera fast enough, so fast that it doesn't go off. And the curious bit is that it's shut at Bruntingthorpe. And the curious bit, with the stick driving, the funny bit is that Hammond several times says, remember, we're doing this with a professional racing driver in a controlled environment, in this almost apologetic tone that you just don't associate with new Top Gear.
No.
And it's, that's natural, isn't it? It found its feet and it evolved and they figured out what worked and they went with that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's quite interesting that even on, well, Top Gear of all eras, they never do anything, certainly not in the UK, which can be proven to be breaking the law. So you'll see, I don't know, Clarkson doing some trans-European thing in a Veyron, and he'll go, right, well, it's time to put my foot down. And the thing just streaks off into the distance. And you see the speedometer just sort of leap round, and it just stops. They just cut at whatever the speed limit is, and then you'll let, and the rest is just all implied. So yeah, but you just don't need to say it, do you? Or you certainly didn't. They didn't feel the need to say, yes, this is done by a professional test driver and a private, environment.
Yeah, they just gave up all that stuff, which is probably why, you know, one of the reasons it became popular, because it was so irreverent. So it's so on BBC actually that people enjoyed watching it for that reason. I think now's probably a good time to have a quick discussion about old Top Gear.
Gosh, I wonder how many people listening to this are old enough to remember old Top Gear.
I remember some of it. I remember Tiff and Quentin.
Yeah? I bet you don't remember. Okay, who was its first presenter? You'll know the name.
I don't know.
Okay. It was a woman.
Yes.
And she's still on telly at the moment.
Yeah. Go on, tell me.
Angela Rippon.
Oh. Yeah, I wouldn't have guessed that.
No, exactly. And, you know, if you look down all the presenters of it, I've got a list here. You know, our friend Jason Barlow did it, the design bloke Stephen Bailey, the late Russell Bulgin, another old mate of mine. Yeah, briefly. Huh? I don't know how many episodes he did. A bloke called Jeremy Clarkson, he was on it. A bloke called James May, he was on it.
Yeah.
VBH, Vicky Butler-Henderson was on it. Brendan Coogan, Steve Coogan's brother, until he was done for drunk driving and got fired. Who else? Chris Goffey, he was a stalwart of it for years. William Willard was the other, and Sue Baker as well. Kate Humble, you know, very well known for... you know, wildlife presenting and everything else these days. Sterling Moss is down here on the list. I don't know what he did.
Really?
Obviously, Tiff, Frank Page, Quentin, Andy Willman. Yeah, I mean, so many people over such a long period of time. I mean, in fact, get this, old Top Gear, you know, we think, gosh, you know, this Top Gear has been running for 20 years. Old Top Gear ran for 24. So they're still not as old as old Top Gear.
Yeah, interesting.
And I mean, it was immensely successful.
Was it? Was it really?
I mean, in its day, yeah, because, I mean, it started off as a little thing. It wasn't even on BBC Nationwide. It was just a sort of, I can't remember who broadcast it, whether it was BBC Midlands or whatever. And then they sort of trialled it for a bit. And it just took off. I mean, it was immensely popular, you know, largely, I guess, because people only had two other channels they could watch. You know, there wasn't even Channel 4 around when that started. And so they pull in massive audiences, you know, I'm sure bigger audiences than were ever pulled in by new Top Gear in the UK, just because people just had no alternatives. And it just became a staple. And it was very earnest most of the time. I mean, certainly the bits that we remember are sort of William Willard presenting Road Test and Sue Baker. And it was, you know, it was a consumer show, wasn't it? It was, you know, it was aimed at people who wanted to find out what new cars were like, because one day they might go out and buy one. And, you know, it got a bit more relaxed. I mean, particularly when people like Quentin came on and Tiff started doing, you know, his stuff and, you know, reviewing racing cars and that sort of thing. So it wasn't all completely straight-laced, but it was such a far cry from the gadabout atmosphere of the Top Gear that we know today. But I mean, it wasn't bad. I mean, it ran for a very, very long time. And by the standards of the 70s and the 80s, and also the other thing was, there was very, very little else around in that space. I mean, it actually had a predecessor. You definitely won't remember this because you weren't alive. It was called Wheelbase.
Right.
And that ran from the mid-60s to the mid-70s. And really, all I remember about that is it was the only way you could get to watch a Grand Prix. So they would, you know, so they would go to, I think they only usually do the European Grand Prix. And they had like a commentator in London. It was usually Raymond Baxter, I think, and three camera positions. So what you'd get is, you know, you get the start and all the cars would go honking off down to the first corner, go around the, and then they just disappear. And then you get sort of shots of scenery for a bit until camera two picked him up halfway around the lap. And then they disappear again. It was all terribly clunky. But, you know, it was live motor racing. Yeah. And sometimes the satellites would go down or, you know, they'd move out of the area or whatever. And it was all just terribly sort of Heath Robinson and Cat Hand at the time. But, of course, we didn't know what we were missing. You know, if you look back at it, you just think, gosh, how shonky that must have been. But at the time, it was amazing. And, I mean, I can remember, you know, just watching, you know, my heroes. I think actually they televised in 1976. I think they televised the Japanese Grand Prix where James Hunt became world champion on it. I'd have been 10. Can't remember. But anyway, yeah. So, you know, but there was just nothing else around at the time. And then new Top Gear came along. And what are your thoughts as to why new Top Gear suddenly just became this extraordinary thing? What was so good about it? What was so different?
And was it planned as well? Was it planned? Because it was when James joined from season two. And then you had that chemistry between Clarkson, Hammond and May. And I think it's that chemistry that is at the heart of it. And it actually, it wasn't until a little bit later on that they started doing films, all three of them. They started doing challenges, all three of them. But they must have had this wonderful light bulb moment when they had the three together at some point and they just realised how entertaining they were to watch.
Yeah, I wonder about that because, I mean, I don't know because I can't remember exactly how it progressed. But my perception was that James, and I say this, you know, with James being one of my oldest friends, I think that he was quite nervy at the beginning.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, Clarkson and Hammond were always incredibly comfortable in front of the camera. You know, they looked like they were born in front of a camera. And James wasn't like that. You could see that he was presenting. And I wonder whether they didn't wonder, because James had already been, I think James had been fired by old Top Gear because they didn't think he was good enough. James might come and tell me this is complete nonsense, but that's what I remember. And I think, and because he was such a good mate by the time he went on the new Top Gear, because we worked together at Autocar for years in the late 90s. I don't mean the late 90s, I mean the late 80s and the early 90s. And I was, you know, I was just worried that, you know, he'd have this sort of bright light moment and then it wouldn't, you know, work out for him. But I think there must have been a moment when suddenly they realised, actually, we've got something here.
Yeah.
But whether it happened bang like that or whether it evolved over a couple of seasons, I can't remember.
I think it took a little bit of time. And you're right. Yeah. When you go and watch May's first few episodes, yeah, he's playing more of a character, that sort of straight-laced, uptight British reserve. That comes through. It's not until later on that you really see him howling with laughter and being silly and messy, cocking about.
And actually, that's a very good point, Dan, because I think they needed him. They asked him to be this character, this Captain Slow character. And he adopted that persona. And because James is such a sort of honest, straightforward guy, I can imagine him finding that awkward. But when he got into it, I think once he learned how to do it, then it was fine and then it became what it became. But when I watch him, even today on Grand Tour, you know, I think that that's still the persona. If you want to know what James is like as a person, go and do the stuff that, go and watch all the other stuff that he does that isn't Top Gear or Grand Tour.
Yeah.
Go and watch James May in Japan, go and watch Man Lab or you know, any of these things. And that's him. And it's a subtly but significantly different person to the person you see on Top Gear. And the non-Top Gear James is James in a way that the Top Gear James isn't quite. Mm. That's Captain Slow.
Do you think they were all, to some extent, playing characters? Because when you watch Clarkson's other stuff, it's a different persona. Probably Hammond as well.
Yeah, I don't really know Richard. I used to know Jeremy reasonably well. I haven't seen him in years. I mean, Jeremy, I think, is playing a version of Jeremy, definitely. An accentuated version of Jeremy and not all of Jeremy. And, you know, I know Jeremy the journalist much more than Jeremy the television presenter. And I know what a professional he is, how incredibly well he writes, and how hard he thinks about stuff. And that contrasts, I think, quite starkly with the, you know, with the idiot that turns up on our television screen. And I think that's a carefully a carefully curated idiot, because that's what works. Richard, I don't really know, because I hardly know him at all. And James, you know, is it's a version of James, but it's not. But I think Clarkson is truer to Clarkson on Top Gear than James is to James.
Mm, yeah, interesting. Okay. So the chemistry between them. What did you, watching them knock about together, having fun, being cruel to each other in a charming way. I think that is probably at the heart of its success. But the other thing that I think is really important around that era of Top Gear is, and I think it's Clarkson's real genius, but there are other people, you know, Andy Willman, the exec producer, maybe even other people like Richard Porter, the script editor. I think what
absolutely.
They understood...
Absolutely. I think Willman and Porter are critical to the success of that. Yeah.
Yeah. I think their real insight into making it such an enormous entertainment show was that they understood that cars... Not many people love cars the way we do, but lots of people are a bit interested because, well, they can be exciting and beautiful and dramatic to watch, but, you know, almost all adults have to drive. Almost all adults have to buy a car. And so they, you know, a car will be their second biggest purchase in life after a house. And so they have good reason to pay attention, and they want to make sure they buy the right car, and they're excited on new car day. So there is this sort of latent interest. And I think those guys, they realize that a TV audience is interested enough in cars for cars to be a hook from which to hang an entertainment show, a family show. And I think that was the true insight. I think that was the super clever thing. And, you know, Clarkson is, I mean, you could argue May as well, but perhaps riding on Clarkson's coattails. But he is the only car journalist who has ever become a household name transcending cars. And I think it's because he always understood that cars could be interesting enough to the average man in the street. And he's so often written and discussed cars in that kind of way, moving away from the super nerdy, geeky, the detail-based stuff that you and I are into, and talking about them in a way that's relatable to a broad audience.
And yet, I agree with all of that.
Yeah.
But there is something else, which is why I think it is so phenomenally clever. Because although it is exactly what you say, it's a show about cars, but using cars as a hook, and it's actually a show about people gadding about.
Yeah.
The first and foremost qualification of presenting that show, or at least having someone on that show, is that you know about cars.
Yeah. It would. That's right.
Reason Clarkson, Hammond, and May worked so well is that behind all the tomfoolery, behind all the mucking about, were three guys who really knew about cars.
Yeah,
and that is why, you know, the wheels came so spectacularly off the bus with Chris Evans, because there was a man who quite clearly was in love with the image of cars, what he thought cars said about him, but. I mean, maybe he does love cars. He never appeared to me to be someone who knew very much about cars or was in any way interested in cars other than in what he thought they said about him. Whereas with Clarkson, Hammond and May, and today, you know, probably more than any of them with Harris, there is an authenticity there. They absolutely know that. I was talking to Kate Humble. Kate lives locally, and she's a mate. And, you know, she said to me that Top Gear was the show which proved to her that you can't present your way, however good you are, you can't present your way out of not knowing your subject or not caring about your subject. Mm. And, you know, and I think there's an awful lot to be said for that. And which is why, you know, with modern Top Gear, I think actually they found a fantastic formula with Paddy and with Fred. And I hope they carry on doing it for a long time. But to me, they're replaceable. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. The one person, and I'm not saying this because he's a mate, although he is, the one person I think that would do, whose removal would do Top Gear more damage than anything else is Chris. Because without Chris, with Chris comes that authenticity. You know, with Chris, that's the show saying, yeah, we're going to be idiots, we're going to fool about it, but actually, don't worry, we know what we're talking about. And while they've got that, I think they've got something. The other thing, just going back to the Clarkson, Hammond, May thing, which I think they've been trying to recapture with varying levels of success ever since, is that they got people who weren't at all interested in cars. And this is the kind of contrast I was talking about, to watch it. Because actually, what people were watching, almost without realising it, was a sitcom.
Yeah. Yeah?
It's Men Behaving Badly on Wheels, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It is.
And that's why people love it, because people just... And that's where the chemistry... That is where... And I think that, honestly, I think they were lucky, but they were clever too. And I think, you know, to a very large extent, when you get brains like Clarkson and Hammond and May and Willman and Porter around, you make a lot of your own luck. And it was the way those three got on together. Also, I would say, tempered by a bit of BBC common sense. You know, I really like the Grand Tour, but to me, it's never been quite as controlled as they were when they were on Top Gear. Because I think when you let them off the leash completely, I don't know, it's just, they kind of just over-rev a little bit. Again, just my opinion. I mean, I still love it. I think it's fantastic. But I think that the three of them being controlled by the BBC was, you know, the greatest motoring show we will ever see. I can't see anyone coming along and doing it better than that, because I think the chance of ever getting three people who work together that well in front of a camera, who know that much about cars, who know that much, but whose interest lies in such different areas of cars, and who are that good on television, and who also interact with each other that well, I just don't think that happens twice. It's lightning.
It is. It is. They captured something, whether it's serendipitous or planned, I don't know, but they...
Yeah.
God, they had something. Yeah, it was powerful. As I said, I was 15 when it started. And a die-hard petrol head, loved cars, but a frustrated one. Because nobody in my family really loved cars. Actually, my uncle is a car enthusiast, a petrol head, but he didn't live locally. And I, you know, I didn't know anyone else who loved cars. I had no way of even sitting in the cars that I was seeing in car magazines. So I had car magazines, and after 2002, I had Top Gear. And I think it was life-changing for me.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, I think it probably made me want to get into this line of work. Clarkson, as I've discussed before on this podcast, was actually a hero to me in my adolescence.
Yeah.
But there was also something weirdly empowering about that show, because they celebrated and had fun with cars, which is what I wanted to do. And they discussed them in a kind of irreverent and fun and silly way. And watching that show, the show became so popular, and yet it was about cars. So somehow it validated my enthusiasm, my passion for cars. It made it less unusual, less abnormal, and more mainstream. And that was a really bizarre thing to sort of experience firsthand. You know, all my friends who didn't really care about cars would talk about Top Gear. And I could talk about it in a more informed way than anybody else. So, you know, it made me feel... Yeah, it gave me this sort of sense of belonging, I guess. So it really meant something to me.
But it's also great, isn't it, when you can have a conversation. You know, I've got a few friends around here who are just intellectually in a different league to me. And I sort of sit there. And they're lovely people. But I'm just struggling to keep up with them, because I'm just not as well-read or and intelligent and quick as them. And, you know, sometimes when you can sit down in a conversation and you can actually just relax because you know the turf. And it's just, you know, and for someone like you to have had, you know, no friends who are particularly interested in cars, very little immediate family who are very interested in cars, suddenly for this thing to come along, which you could all talk about together, and you had this thing, this shared thing in common, and it being something which you just, you know, you probably thought, well, I probably know a bit more about this than most of you guys. That must have just been... I can see why it changed your life. I can absolutely see why it was such on a young chap's mind, feeling sort of, you know, out on his own a bit, and then suddenly finding this constituency of people through this television program that you can have this shared common, I don't, well, it would have been a passion for you, for them it would have just been an interest, but it doesn't matter. That would have, I can completely understand that.
It was very powerful for me, very powerful. And of course, if there's a third element that made that show so successful, it must have been fantastic ideas.
Yes.
And, you know, so many spring to mind right away, like trying to kill a Toyota Hilux. And the superb stuff they did with it.
Yeah.
Putting it on top and, of a building that's going to be...
It's the idea and then the execution of the idea.
Yeah.
I mean... the Hilux, I think, is obviously a standout case. And you just sat there thinking, but all the time, have they killed it? And then when it failed, you just think, well, what are they going to do next?
Yeah.
And then when they stuck it on top of that building and blew up the building. I mean, honestly, I think in terms of the spectacle, the surprise, the idea, I think that is television at its absolute best. That is... riveting. You know, you don't have to give a toss about cars to find that absolutely riveting. And the adventures, you know, the North Pole thing they did, well, actually, technically the magnetic North Pole, but let's not, you know, you know, and okay, one of the things I wanted to discuss with you was that one of my problems with Top Gear as it evolved through the Clarkson Hammond May era is that with every successive series, it became more of a scripted show. Insofar as you could see that so much of what you were seeing was a setup. And when you suddenly realise that what you're looking at is a very carefully and cleverly crafted show, rather than almost just reportage on the adventures of these idiots, to me, it lost something. And I just wonder whether you felt that, or whether, you know, when they are... I mean, I remember that, you know, one of the last things they did, but they did those things with ambulances and how to get a patient to the hospital very quickly. And I think it was Hammond ended up sort of firing one through some kind of rocket through the back door. And I can remember crying with laughter. It was one of the funniest things I've ever seen. But please don't tell me that was in any way real. It was just, you know, it was just a bit of fun. And I was a bit torn because while I could appreciate that what I was watching was hilarious, it was hilarious in the same way that Fawlty Towers was hilarious. It wasn't, to me, in any way real anymore. And although, you know, a lot of the stuff they did was real and you know, and fine and interesting and fun, there was, to me, increasingly too much of that scripted stuff going on towards the end.
It's, for me, it's suspension of disbelief, as it is with any piece of fiction or any piece of television or movie or anything. And when it's at its best, you're quite happy to suspend your disbelief and you're quite happy
to go
along with it. And even if you know what's coming, even if you see the gag coming over the horizon, it's funny and you still laugh. But absolutely, there are times
sometimes the gag is funnier because you know it's coming.
And it just tickles for that reason.
When I was a kid, there's a film which was made in the mid-70s, which you may have seen, but only because Harris would have made you see it, because it's one of his favourite films. It's called The Return of the Pink Panther, okay? And it's got Jacques Clouseau, okay? And there's a bit where Clouseau is in a room with a vacuum cleaner and a parrot, okay? And the parrot's loose in the room, and you already know what's going to happen, don't you? Sooner or later, the parrot's going up the vacuum cleaner. And they string it out for about 10 minutes. And then when the parrot finally does go up the vacuum cleaner, because you know that's what's ultimately going to happen from the moment he walks in the room,
That's
what's funny, because you're proven right.
So, so that can work.
It's that, isn't it?
But no, I completely agree with you there. Maybe it had a lull, or maybe it became too familiar. But it reached a point where it felt overdone. It felt maybe too obvious. But that's natural, isn't it? Because it can't go on forever and ever being amusing in the same way.
And also, the other thing I would say, absolutely in its defence, is it's not aimed at me. You know, I am. You know, I don't do what they do for a living, but I do cars for a living.
Yeah.
You know, I
ride adjacent things.
Yeah, and you know, I'm not the target audience, because if I was the target audience, it would never have got broadcast, because there aren't enough me's around at all. So, you know, I think they were absolutely right to use that poetic license to broaden its appeal, to appeal to people, you know, who are, you know, not as obsessed with cars and don't spend their entire life in and around cars like you and I do. And if the price of that was that people like me sort of look down on those and go, well, I'm sure they didn't actually do that, or, you know, they didn't do it, then, you know, fair, absolutely, you know, fair enough. But I guess we all just, you know, see these things, excuse me, differently.
Yeah. Do you know, we could keep doing this forever, but there were other reasons, because Top Gear, particularly with the specials, it became part travel show. And again, the one that springs to mind is the Botswana special.
That was the best one they did.
That was 15 years ago. So they're only 5 years into that new format, and they did that. I think that's the best one. I think that is peak Top Gear. But quite apart from the fact that it's celebrating these interesting cars, and quite apart from the fact that it's three blokes knocking about together, it's beautifully shot. It takes you through Botswana. And you see how spectacular the place is. And again, that's probably why it appealed to families, because there's more going on than just talking about, so much more going on than just talking about cars.
But that, I mean, that shows why success breeds success, because, you know, that Botswana show, because Top Gear by then was so successful,
yeah,
you know, they had the money to do that.
They could do it.
And they could have squandered that, but they didn't, because by then, you know, they just ticked every box, didn't they? You know, they had the idea, they had the presenters, and then they had the execution, and everything was perfect. You know, they could have done that same show, but with three other people, and it wouldn't have been anything like as good. Or they could have done it, but somewhere, you know, nothing like as interesting as Botswana. Or they could have done it there and filmed it as a bit of a, you know, from the hip travelogue. And again, you know, change one element and the magic is gone. And what was so superb, so brilliant about that was that they just had it all. But ultimately, I think you're right. I think it just comes down to the idea. That's, you know, and that's certainly on TI what we think about, is we try quite hard. Sometimes we have to, because a new car comes out and we need to review it. But we try quite hard to do stuff that other people haven't done, because we think that's, you know, more interesting. And I think with a lot of their travel things, and just the ambition as well. You know, we're going to drive a car to the magnetic North Pole, despite the fact that no one's ever done it before. You know, and we're just a bunch of television presenters. Oh, and by the way, we'll make Hammond run most of the way there and get towed by dogs the rest of the time. You know, that's, you can't see old Top Gear doing that or any other show. And it was spellbinding because of it.
Yeah, that was spectacular, that one. Now, we're celebrating this show because, well, I loved it, but it wasn't perfect. And we've spoken about how at times it felt too scripted. And of course, there were endless controversies going over the line on more than one occasion. We don't really need to get into those. So it wasn't a perfect show by any means. We know why. I'm interested to know, from your point of view, what did it mean, if anything, for other car media, magazines, maybe other TV shows? Did it elevate other titles to some degree, or did it just blow everything out of the water?
Well, I think it did to almost just by accident or by a... I mean, obviously, you know, Top Gear magazine came along. That's actually the reason why Fifth Gear was called Fifth Gear, because when Top Gear got canned, old Top Gear got canned, Channel 5 wanted to do it, and they wanted to call it Top Gear, but they couldn't, because Top Gear magazine existed by then, which is why they called it Fifth Gear. And, you know, Top Gear magazine has been out for a very long time now. And because, you know, they have a free house ad to many millions of people on a lot of Sunday nights. And a lot of public, I don't know if it is public money anymore. No, it probably isn't anymore. But, you know, they had a lot of resources. And they could, you know, they always get the Top Gear presenters to write their columns. You know, they had an incredible inbuilt advantage. And I think that did force other motoring media to raise their game. to respond to it. I think, you know, so if you look at Fifth Gear, you know, I think, you know, they haven't, you know, that is a much more conventional motoring program, because they've never had, and in fact, if they tried to be Top Gear, they would have absolutely killed them, I'm sure. So, you know, they have tried to do it a more conventional way. And, you know, Fifth Gear has been around for a very, very long time. I mean, I know it's had its ups and downs and everything else, but, you know, it has survived. But nothing has ever come close to the success of Top Gear, and I think you know, I think we know why.
Yeah. And of course, you've mentioned that James May is an old friend of yours. Was it bizarre watching him become, I think, probably one of the most recognisable people in Britain?
I think, yeah, it was a bit. It was a bit. I think I was helped by the fact that I didn't really think it was James up there. So that kind of, and also the, what I was helped by massively, and it's exactly the same to this day, is, and Christopher's exactly the same. You know, they have not, in the way they interact with their friends, they haven't changed at all. So, you know, I see James or I see Chris, and I, there is no sense in which I'm thinking, gosh, you know, there's a famous television presenter. I'm just seeing James and I'm just seeing Chris. So from that point, so I think I've been pretty successfully able to sort of divorce what they do for a living and what we do as mates down the pub. And, you know, and if that hadn't been the case, if they had changed or in any way become sort of starry or been affected by their roles in televisions, I think we'd have struggled because they wouldn't have been the person that, you know, had been my buddy. So, yeah. So it was, I mean, it was odd. Because I don't think that I actually knew anybody. Well, I suppose I knew, I probably would have known Clarkson a little bit, but, you know, Clarkson is somebody who I know. I mean, you know, he's an acquaintance. I, you know, he's not someone that I would in any way describe as a friend. Only because, you know, I just haven't seen that much of him. But James was. So James was the first person who was a friend who got famous. And I guess that's a bit sort of strange. But actually, you notice it most when you're sitting in a pub. And what happens is one person will come up and ask for an autograph or a selfie, at which stage the entire pub suddenly feels empowered to do the same. And, you know, I can remember once it took me 20 minutes to get him out of a building because we'd been sitting there quite quietly and you could see people looking, and then one of them plucked up the courage. And because both James and Chris are so unbelievably good with people who do that, as they should be, because as they rightly say, you know, these are the people who pay who pay our wages. They always take the time. They always ask questions of, you know, people who've been kind enough to come up to them. But it does get quite time consuming. So, you know, quite often, you know, we'll just end up in each other's houses or whatever because it's easier.
Yeah. Yeah, it's more annoying for us, it seems, isn't it, trying to hang out with these guys. Yeah, so the only other thing I wanted to talk about with Top Gear was the Dunsfold test track, because that was a proper Top Gear innovation, having a studio and a test track outside. It meant they could do so much with it. And, you know, in 15 years working in this industry, I went to Dunsfold once in 2008 and then never again until this month, where I've been twice. I spent a bit of time at Dunsfold recently, and it's an interesting place. I mean,
it's not a great track, is it?
It's not brilliant, but, you know, given that it is an old airfield and they've just had to use what was there, it's not like Silverstone where they've developed it into a really great circuit. It's literally, it's a stack of tyres in one spot and some lines on the road. And actually, it's a reasonable circuit, given that. You know, you've got a mix of corners. There's some tight fiddly stuff, some properly quick ballsy stuff. I was there with the GT3 RS, the new one, and it was so frustrating because the weather was just foul. The track was so wet, and when you're coming off that back straight into the second to last corner, well, the approach to that corner, you're going from a wide expansive runway to a narrow,
it's a really difficult corner, isn't it?
It's so tough
to spot it properly.
It's really tough to spot it. But then when it's wet, you're going from grippy tarmac to super slippery concrete. It's like it's like asphalt to ice. And the car just slides, washes out underneath you. You've got to be so careful. But yeah, I mean, given what they had to work with, I think they did a pretty good job of turning it into, you know, a sort of worthwhile circuit. But you're limited, aren't you, with what you can do with what's actually still an active airfield.
So let me ask you, and we're not going to dwell on Top Gear of today, but do you think it will endure into the EV era? Do you think it's going to become a show about historics? Can you see them tramping across, you know, the middle of absolutely nowhere in their electric this, that, and the other? Or do you think that the business has changed so much, the way that people interact with cars is changing and will change so much that it's the time will come when that sort of service just naturally had its day? Or maybe we'll need it even more because we will be so, we'll miss it all so much that all we'll have is just idiots mucking about in cars on telly. I don't know.
It's a very good point. And do you know what? I'm just thinking about it now as you speak. You know, when they do a Botswana special, or when they all choose a car and take it somewhere, one of the key elements there is that each presenter at least pretends to love their car, and they throughout the entire episode they are making the case for why their car is the best, and they're willing their own cars along. And maybe that's just playing on something that we all have within us, where we feel some kind of enthusiasm or affinity for the car that we own. Maybe
can you see them doing that in their Volkswagen ID4s?
Well, that's the problem, isn't it? And even more so when lots of us don't own cars, but we just rent them by the hour.
Yeah.
Then suddenly that instinct for that sense of possession over a vehicle is gone.
I think it will continue, but I think it will need reinventing. And that's when you're going to need somebody really clever, because I think... And I haven't really thought about this at all until now, as you could probably tell. But I suspect there is a gem of a format just waiting. And it could be reinvented in the same way that Willman and Clarkson reinvented it 20 years ago. And you could make a new Top Gear for the EV generation. And I think you keep... it would still have to be anarchic. It would still have to be fun. But whether it existed to sort of represent the world that had gone, or whether it found a way of still being relevant, and that's the thing, isn't it? Does it need to be relevant? Does it still need to be a consumer show? Does it need ultimately to have views about cars? Or is it okay that it's just, as I said earlier, men behaving badly on wheels? And that the actual key is just to have some presenters who get on well together, can muck about together, and they just happen to do it in cars.
Yeah, it's a very interesting point. I think Fifth Gear have gone all electric. Maybe it's just for a standalone series or something, but yeah, it's an interesting one. They're still called Fifth Gear. It should be One Gear, really, shouldn't it, if it's all about electric cars? Gear. someone will come along there, won't they? Someone will reinvent it and be clever and think of something that we haven't done, and maybe they'll make another... It's hard to imagine it happening again, another global phenomenon out of a car show, but who knows? So there you go, Top Gear. Okay, well, we've got a listener question coming up. You have not been briefed. Actually, no, you can fill us in on some of this question, but I've made some notes. So before we do that, let me just say thank you all to listening. Thank you all for listening. Thank you all for rating and reviewing the podcast. I can see you doing it. It makes a big difference because that's how we find new listeners. So please keep doing it. And if you haven't already, check out the-intercooler.com, our website, or go and download our app from the App Store, The Intercooler. So the listener question this week comes from, I hope I'm getting your name right, Uri. And Uri wants to know, we're all aware that the Alpine A110 scored 10 out of 10 in a TI road test. It's our only 10 out of 10. And the GT3 is a 9 out of 10, and he gives some others. But he wants to have examples for each score. So I've just run through our recent reviews, and I've got a handful here. So 9 out of 10 cars is the 911 GT3, 911 GT3 RS, Cayman GT4 RS, VW ID Buzz.
There's a theme here.
No, VW ID Buzz. I put that one in there intentionally. Aston Martin DBX 707, McLaren Artura, Toyota GR86. 8 out of 10 is 296 GTS, the Ferrari. Bentley Bentayga extended wheelbase, Porsche Cayenne Turbo GT, Caterham 420 Cup, Supra Manual, Maserati MC20. 7 out of 10, 296 GTB. Andrew English actually preferred the GTS, which is interesting. Caterham 170S, Puma ST, current Golf GTI, 6 out of 10, BMW i4 M50, Audi S3, BMW Z4, the 2-litre one, and 5 out of 10, I think we've only ever had two fives, Mini JCW GP, John Cooper Works GP, VW Polo GTI. So they're just a few examples, but I think people want to know, why isn't there a 3 out of 10 in there? You know, and what's the point in having scores one to four?
Well, I mean, I think it's a very good point. Because I guess that there is, it's this thing which I do rail against a bit, but I understand why people say it. there's no such thing as a bad car anymore. Because cars tend to be of a standard. So maybe we should start with a position that, you know, 0 out of 10 is an average car. It's interesting, but to me, if you're 5 out of 10, that means you're mediocre. You're not terrible, because we don't drive cars. You don't really get into cars these days and think, this is a terrible car. It just doesn't happen. A terrible car is a car that, you know, that breaks down or is so uncomfortable you can't drive it, or is in some way terminally flawed. And, you know, because of legislation, because of the way car manufacturers are these days, you know, those cars just don't seem to appear. And maybe we should take that into account. We don't at the moment. But, you know, a car would, to score less than five, a car would, I'm not saying it couldn't happen. I mean, it might well do. I certainly don't rule it out. But a car would have to be woeful. And you just don't get true. You can get cars which are dull. You can get cars which are disappointing. You can get cars which are flawed. But they very, very, very rarely tend to. You get a new car from a massive OEM with all the things they already have to comply with. So it's already going to be safe, and it's going to be reliable. And cars have also got better because, you know, the customer is so much more savvy these days. The customer, you know, researches these things, knows all about them. You know, 30 years ago, it wasn't possible because there was no internet. And so you could make really shit cars, you know, and, you know, Ford used to, and stick Ford badges on them. People would go and buy them because they didn't know any better. Well, they do these days. So it's really difficult. And if you did make a shit car, it simply wouldn't sell. So people don't do it. So, you know, so that's the reason that we do it. And I think there is an argument, and maybe we can have a conversation about it, but then we'd have to go back and then reorder all the previous ones according to our new rules, whatever they happen to be. But that's why we do it, whether we're right or wrong to do it. I understand why some people might think one way and others the other.
That's right. There is an argument to say, let's imagine you've got a 5-star system. If a car gets 1 star, well done, you've built an adequate car and you get a star for that. If it's a good car, it gets 3 stars. You know, it's a good car, so it gets 3 stars. Well done. And the manufacturer should be pleased with 3 stars. And only if it's truly outstanding does it get a 5. But we see it in every aspect of car media, I think. Scores seem to be skewed upwards. So it's, you know, 3. It's so rare to see a car get a 3-star rating. 3.5 seems
five.
To be. Yeah. 3.5 seems to be the lowest that is.
Yeah.
That tends to. And almost everything is a 4. And so we do try, don't we? We do try to be stricter, generous
The fact that we've only ever had 1 10 out of 10, or in other people speak 5 out of 5, tells you all you need to know. You know, we are, you know, because to us, if the car is the best car in its class, and, you know, that's why we're talking about the ID Buzz, we're talking about the DBX 707, we're talking about those Porsches. They are, you know, they get 9 out of 10 because they're the best cars in their class. That's what 9 out of 10 means to us. To get a 10 out of 10, you need to be game changing. Mm. And that's the point. And others don't have that distinction. For them, a 10 out of 10 car is the best car in its class. But that doesn't leave any room for a car like an A110, which comes along and just, you know, resets the boundaries of what that kind of car should be like. So we are tougher than everybody else, I think, and our star ratings mean slightly different things. So I think we are tough, we are more discerning. I think there's an argument which says we could be even tougher, and we've talked about it. So, yeah, it's a very, very interesting question.
But we do at least try to be transparent, and that's why I chose to answer this question on the podcast, because we want all of you to understand where it is we're coming from. And transparency is just so important. So thank you for your question. Keep them coming. It's a fun way to end each episode of the podcast. We'll do it again next week.
Before then.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.